I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning to speak to you on this subject, because it is something that is very special to me and something that has really caused the journey that I've taken in my life. As was said earlier, I attended University of Mississippi, that school across the state line over there, struggled about my sophomore and junior year with the information that was being given to me by college professors, these ones with PhDs, those ones as students that we look up to. And I was being told that the earth was billions of years old, that we evolved from monkeys, that Noah's flood was not a global event. And it really created some turmoil in my life because of where I had been as a youngster, being brought up in the church, and had taken the Bible to be and to say what it said. That every verse in that Bible was inspired by God. That every verse in that Bible was true. That every verse in that Bible was directed to me and for me to follow. At one time, I even took a few days off from school and went to one of our Christian colleges to try to get some answers. And I don't know if it was because I was just too dumb to ask the right questions, but I didn't get the answers I was looking for. And so I compromised in my own mind, and I want to tell you about my journey of where I was, what I went through, and where I am today. And young people, I'm here this morning to express to you, the students, that you'll be getting some information in school that, you know, well, I look around, I guess the young people are in class, aren't they? Parents. Get this information and be able to share it with your children so that they'll have some background and some understanding to fight what they're going to fight while they're in school. Well, as I was taking this journey, we were living in Jackson, Mississippi, where I was working for the Department of Environmental Quality, and I got a call one day from a headhunter, one of those that are trying to place somebody into a particular job. And my wife and daughter at the time were in Tupelo visiting her parents during the summer. And Monica, who's here this morning, who will keep me straight if I mess up here, she told me, I could tell that she didn't really want me to go because we were in Jackson and she always wanted to go back to Tupelo. Why can't we live in Tupelo? Your mom and dad are close by. My parents would be close by. It'd be so much better. Well, there weren't a whole lot of jobs for a geologist in Tupelo, Mississippi. So I got this call and decided I'd go down and take that interview. And make a long story short, instead of coming to Tupelo, where she wanted to be, we moved 2.5 hours further south. And at that time, I don't think she was real happy. But let me tell you, God had a plan. Because while we were in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and attending the Goodwood Boulevard Church of Christ, I was browsing through their library one day, and I ran across this book called The Genesis Flood. The Genesis Flood, written by a geologist and an engineer, and it had in it what I needed. It had scientific information in there for a young earth, for a global flood, and I needed that so bad. And that started me on my journey, that one book. Later, a couple years later, I was giving a talk in San Diego, California, at one of those conferences with a name on it this long. And while we were out there, I gave the talk, and Monica and the kids came out later, probably because they didn't want to hear the talk. But we finished the conference, and she came out, and we went to the Institute of Creation Research. Well, folks, I was like a child in a candy store. I thought she was going to take the Visa card away from me. Because there were books, there were videos, there were There was all this information that were written by scientists that were given information that I needed so bad. Because to be honest with you, I had been accused of being a person of little faith because I was questioning all this. You know, there's no reason to question anything. But look for the answers. Start searching, start studying, start looking for those answers. So that was the journey that got me going in the direction I'm going now. And I appreciate the opportunity that Apologetics Press has given me to go out and give talks, because I consider it a mission of my personal life to be able to share this information with, especially with young people, because that's where I was. That's where I was struggling. That's where the problem started. So as you'll see out in the foyer, there's a lot of information out there that Apologetics Press has written. Look at it. See what there might be there to help you and help your children. And if I can remember how to get this started, the talk this morning is design and natural attenuation. And natural attenuation simply means a chemical compound naturally attenuates or naturally degrades, and I'll explain that as we go through the lesson. This is a Superfund site that I worked at for about 13 years in Baton Rouge. I was hired, that's the job I went to perform after the headhunter had called and we moved to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I was totally dedicated to this one client, because this Superfund site was created back in the early 70s by what I call a mom and pop operation. They had a pumper truck, a vacuum truck, that they would go to all the chemical refineries and the chemical plants in the Baton Rouge area. They'd pick up the waste into the vacuum truck, take it out here where they had dug some holes in the ground, and dumped it. This was back before any rules and regulations, but when it was first discovered of what had happened was one summer day where we had the monsoon rains that are not that uncommon in South Louisiana, and the dikes around these lagoons broke. And you had this black liquid, some very nasty chemicals in it, that flowed out of these lagoons and into what's known as Baton Rouge Bayou. Us here in North Alabama, North Mississippi, would call that a creek. It's a bay in Louisiana. It flowed into the bay. So it went into that bayou. It flowed on through down the bayou, down into what's called Devil Swamp, which empties into the Mississippi River. The story we heard was that day that those dikes broke, the cattle that lived in the adjacent pasture land walked across the pasture, drank out of the creek like they'd done all their lives, and headed back to the barn to be fed, and half the herd didn't make it back. Killed half the herd in that one day. Make a long story short, the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ, the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, got involved. It went to federal court. And the federal court went back to the generators because the little mom and pop operation immediately claimed bankruptcy. Matter of fact, one of the elders of the church in Baton Rouge was hired by the insurance company of the mom and pop operation to go out there and take a look at the site. This happened long before I knew him, but he was telling me the story. Went out there and he said, "Jimmy, that was the nastiest place I'd ever seen. The ground was just black from this waste. There were leaking drums all over the place. Everyone that worked on the site, some of those that had been out there for years with no protection, no air protection, they were losing their hair, their gums were receding, but they didn't care. It was putting money on the table." He said he talked to the insurance company and told them it's going to cost millions of dollars to clean this up. And they said, whoa, wait a minute. We've only got them insured for $500,000. He said, write them the check and get out of town because this is fixing to get ugly. I was involved at that site for 13 years, and when I left, over $185 million had been spent trying to clean it up. But what we learned as we went through this process was that a lot of the things that we had spent money on wasn't really necessary. The geology of this particular area is pretty complex. What you see here is like looking at the side of a cake, where you're looking at the frosting, the cake, frosting, cake. Well, the blue is alluvial deposits. That's deposits that were put down by the Mississippi River. And nothing is continuous. The frosting of the cake, you start looking at it coming across the frosting, all of a sudden you got cake again. So we had sands, clay, sands. Nothing was lenticular. Nothing was continuous across the site, which made it very complex in trying to model. And we're trying to model it with a groundwater model to tell us how many wells to put in to try to recover this waste, what the spacing of those wells should be. Very complex geology. As you go on further down and get into the green, what you see here in the green, those are Pleistocene deposits. And those were more continuous. But the problem was that the waste was deposited up there in the top. So it's up in this area that are not continuous. You got clay, silt, sands. It makes it very difficult to model. And this is what's happening in the subsurface. You see in this green, that's our source area. That was the pit that this waste was put in. You put back your truck up, dump it out into this pit. Nowadays, in order to be legal, that would be lined with clay and then some kind of synthetic fiber. There'd be all kinds of protection before this would be allowed. This was just a hole dug in the ground that they went out and put this waste in. Well, this waste is called a DINAPL. It's a dense, non-aqueous phase liquid, which means, first off, it's heavier than water. So what happens when it gets into the water? It sinks. It's more dense than the water. It's also, when it gets down into the water and the water passes by, it starts dissolving. Let's say that the waste pit was up here in the front of the auditorium. The Mississippi River is out here in the parking lot. So as that waste goes down, it's going to pass by each one of you as it goes out to the parking lot, moves toward the Mississippi River. And that was our job to protect. It will not get to the Mississippi River. That was our directive from EPA. So the first thing to do, the first thing I was hired to do, was to develop this groundwater model to show where to put the wells in order to contain it. At this point in time, that's all we knew to do, contain it. In order to pump the water down and where you create a bowl in the subsurface, and this bowl will contain this waste. In order to do that, we developed a groundwater model, and the first thing you do, this is something that's done on a computer, and it simulates the way that water flows in the subsurface. And the first thing you have to do is duplicate what we know has occurred in the past. So we had to take water levels in what's called piezometers. You go out and you measure and see where the water level is in each one of these zones. The second thing to do is to be able to create a boundary condition with the Mississippi River, because we want to, when the river comes up, the flow direction is back toward the site. When the river comes down, the flow direction is toward the river. So we have to be able to simulate that in order to match or satisfy the conditions that EPA has put upon us. So we were able to do that, and then we had to explain what is going on with all these chemicals. Now, I put that up there to scare you, because there's a lot of big words up there and a lot of big chemicals, and scientists love throwing those out to show how smart they are. Now, the reason for this slide is to understand how difficult this proposition was to model this change in chemistry as these compounds degrade. Let me back up. When we were doing the investigation and putting the wells in, 188 wells were eventually put in the well field in this area at a cost, during installation of about $1 million a month. These chemicals are degrading under aerobic and anaerobic conditions, under conditions where we have oxygen, under conditions that we don't have oxygen. And when we were putting the well field in, we were also doing a subsurface investigation down in the bayou area, and we started getting this chemical, this hit of this chemical called vinyl chloride. That wasn't part of the parent material. We had trichloroethane, tetrachloroethane, all these ethanes and ethenes. Vinyl chloride wasn't dumped out here. Where is this coming from? Nobody understood. This was back in the early to mid-90s. Why do we have vinyl chloride showing up down gradient? So we did these microcosm studies trying to figure out what's going on. We took the waste, we took actual dirt from the site, created these long tubes that stood up in the air 10 feet and put some of the waste in there, and we're going to measure the concentrations of these chemicals over time to see what's going on. As we did that, we thought, well, we'll set it up in the lab and we'll come back and we'll measure it in 30 days. Because see, what's supposed to be happening is you have chemical A, should degrade down to chemical B, chemical C, chemical D, and end up with ethene and vinyl chloride. Ethene and water, excuse me. And if it degrades all the way down to ethene and water, guess what? We don't have a problem anymore. Because what we're scared of is if it gets hung up at vinyl chloride is more carcinogenic and more mobile than our parent material. Our parent material was carcinogenic, but not very mobile. In other words, it's going to stay pretty close. It's not going to spread out a great deal. But if we get to vinyl chloride, it's very mobile. We put a drop of it here. It's like putting a drop of oil out in the parking lot after it's rained. And you know how you'll see it start spreading out and creating that sheen? Well, that's what we're afraid of. We're afraid it's going to start spreading and it's going to get out of control and we won't be able to do anything about it. But we know it's degrading, but here's the question. Why? What's the mechanism for these chemicals to be degrading? Again, this is in the early 90s, and the scientists do not understand. We know it's degrading, but we don't know why. So we created what's called a reactive transport model so that we can simulate each one of these chemicals. And again, we're really most concerned about vinyl chloride because it is more mobile than the remaining chemicals. So we modeled it to see what the extent would be. And this was very interesting because you see the extent, you're looking at the site and you see, let's see, is there a pointer on here? Which is the red button?
I'm not sure you can see it, but you can hit the red button.
Okay. Well, you see the calibrated model in 1995, that's where we knew it was in 1995. And then our predictions and our source, of course, source area is continuing to move out, so we see the extent. Well, that was a lot of fun because EPA was requiring us to be able to simulate this movement out to the year 2500. Folks, at the year 2500, I didn't care where it was going to be. You know, I could be right or wrong, and they're going to have to find me somewhere else at 2500. But that's what they wanted us to do. They wanted us to be able to predict out about 500 years where these chemicals were going to be. And if about the bottom of your screen is where the Mississippi River is. So we were able to simulate this, and we called it natural attenuation. Chemicals are naturally attenuating, but we still don't know what the driving mechanism is. We can quantify the breakdown of each of the chemicals. We know it's going to vinyl chloride, but we don't know how it's happening. What is going on? If you could play that video, please. What you see here, if you could pick it out. If it starts off as very small, what you're looking at is what's occurring in the subsurface and how this final chloride is moving out. And it's the blue concentrations are not very high. You get up into the yellows and the reds and the greens, that is up in the source area where you've got free phase or the actual chemicals in place. The blue is what's dissolved in the subsurface and moving out. What EPA really liked about this was that we can see it moving. That way they know we're actually simulating something, but it gets out to a point and it reaches steady state conditions. In other words, that's as far out as it's gonna move. But I'm not sure you can see it here, but we also simulated the effects of the Mississippi River. Remember what I said earlier? Mississippi River up flows back towards the site. Mississippi River down, the subsurface flow is toward the river. Well, it gets out to a steady state condition, and the only effect or the only driving force on it is that river. And so it just starts ebbing back and forth like a tide. And that got to be a real good selling point with the EPA. Yeah, it's still active, it's still there, but it's just ebbing back and forth with the Mississippi River. But they still wouldn't sign off on it. Because again, at this point, we don't know what the driving force is behind it. Let's come up something more current. The Deepwater Horizon disaster. This rig exploded April 20th, 2010, and we were understanding or knew that 11 workers had been killed. Very serious accident. And where I'm going with this, I don't want you to forget that it was a disaster. We had young men that were rig workers that were killed on that site, and we had devastating effects to wildlife. But you remember, the news was saying that this is going to be something that's going to take decades to clean up. It's an environmental disaster in the Gulf like we've never seen before. I was hired to come down there and start sampling out in the Gulf and along the shore to start trying to quantify these oil concentrations. Devastating. What it did to the wildlife and the loss of life. 4.9 million barrels of oil. That's a sight, the shot of the Gulf water surface as we're going out to collect samples. And you can see in the sample jars there the actual samples that are going to be sent to the lab. We had a crew of about 6 or 8 guys that went out working 24 hours a day out on a crew boat taking samples out in the Gulf. My job was to go out and transfer those samples from their boat to the boat that I was going to be on and bring them back in, get them iced down, and sent off to the lab, because there's a very, very short time span from the time you get the samples, the time you collect the samples, to the time you get them to the lab. So I was go out one afternoon, and I'm told to take a crew boat, a boat that's designed to carry 75 to 100 people out to a rig, and guess how many was on there? 2 crews, about 4 men each, and me. That's a lot of money spent to get about 50 coolers of samples back in to send to the lab. We had satellite phones, and I was able to talk to the guys that are out in the Gulf and say, okay, we're gonna be leaving at such and such time. Where do you anticipate your location to be by the time we can get there? And they gave me a grid location. I take that grid location to the captain of the boat that's taking me out, and I say, okay, we're supposed to meet them in this particular grid. He goes in and gets one of his charts, one of his maps, pulls it out, brings it out, and he rolls it out, and he starts looking, and he says, are you sure that's right? I said, well, that's what they told me. That grid's not on this map. Hold on a minute, let me go back. So he goes back in, comes out with another map, rolls it out on the table. He said, man, that's south of Mobile, Louisiana. Mobile, Alabama. Forget where I was and where I am. Mobile, Alabama. We're in Port Fouchon. It's going to take us 8 hours to get there. I said, well, I guess we better get moving. So we traveled all night long to go out and get these samples from the crew that's collecting them. And it was probably going to be some lawsuits involved over this rig explosion. So I'm the only person, only technical person on this boat to go out and get these samples. And I'm reminded, those coolers can never be out of your sight. And I said, well, you know, it's going to be a 16-hour trip, not counting the time it's going to take to transfer them over to our boat. Am I not going to be able to sleep? Well, we're not going to be able to see you. So what did somebody do on the boat? They took a picture. Got a picture of me sleeping. Well, I figure the samples are out there on the deck, and who's going to get them? It's just us. Just like with the chemicals that we had at the site in Louisiana, we now know that we have these oil-eating microbes that are eating the oil out in the Gulf. Remember what they said? It's a disaster of unknown proportions. The Gulf Coast of Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama will never be the same. Well, we now know that these oils that contain these hydrocarbons, these CH4 molecules, we have the oxygen that's needed for the reactions, and these microbes can break apart the hydrocarbons, and they continue or combine them with oxygen and just create water and carbon dioxide. No problem. That's what we've learned. That's what we learned during and after this disaster. Well, let's back to Louisiana. We didn't know, we knew these chemicals were breaking down, but we didn't know what the driving mechanism was. So we'd done these microcosm studies where we are able to look at the chemicals, where the parent compounds, what it starts with, and how it starts breaking down and goes to vinyl chloride and eventually to ethane and water, but we don't know how or why. So samples were sent to LSU, and they started looking at the DNA, or looking at the water, finding these microbes in the water. And you look, the bacterial diversity found in moderately acidic anaerobic groundwater contaminated by the Stenapple, and the actual found a species, or for the very first time, gave a species, a microbe, a name based on the Superfund site. Up until this point, we didn't know they were there. We didn't know what the driving mechanism was. Back to the oil spill. A quote from an article from the University of California at Berkeley. Scientists have been puzzled by the disappearance of oil in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Where is it going? This is supposed to be, if we listen to CNN, to Fox News, to NBC, ABC, CBS, everybody else, this is going to be a disaster that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren will be cleaning up. But somehow, this oil has disappeared. From the Science Insider, natural processes removed or dispersed about 41% of the spilled oil. And this was an article entitled, Mother Nature Having Her Way with Gulf Oil. You noticed in this particular title how some scientists have a real problem in saying God? What do they call God? Mother Nature. Mother Nature having her way. And I really like this one, the oil, from an article entitled "Oil-Eating Microbes Seen as Possible Solution to the Spill." One scientist compares them to the yellow chompers in the Pac-Man video game, hungry little single-minded little microbes fueled by the same fertilizer farmers use on soybeans, gobbling the hydrocarbons from the oily waters, marshes, and shores of the Gulf of Mexico. Wow. Mother Nature? We scientists call this process bioremediation. And again, we didn't know those microbes were there until, you know, less than 10 years ago. God had a plan. God had a plan when we tried to, when we made a mistake, made an environmental mistake, just like God has a plan when we make a spiritual mistake. And we call that plan Jesus. That plan, when we made environmental mistakes, he put these little bacteria in the earth that'll clean up the oil. You know, as a teenager, what did I do when I changed the oil in my car? Well, there's a fence. Don't do that now, it's illegal. But God had a plan. Here's a picture of a glob of oil, and you can barely see, it's under a scanning electron microscope. There we go. You can see these microbes starting to travel to this oil. Well, where did these microbes come from? God had a plan, and we have sometimes have really tried to mess it up. These little microbes, God's design. Little cartoon of them, they just actually glob oil. These microbes come to attack it. They encirculate that, and they actually release these enzymes that start breaking the oil down. We didn't know they were there, but God had a plan. It's amazing to me that we don't want to diminish the effects that this disaster that happened out in the Gulf. Like I said earlier, there was loss of life. 11 people were killed in the explosion. There was a loss of a lot of wildlife. But God had a great design. This evolutionary theory that I came from a monkey. Now, there's some people out there that might agree that I came from a monkey. But my question always is, if I came from monkey, where'd that monkey come from? Well, you see, there was an amphibian that developed into a mammal. All right, let's say I buy that. Where'd that amphibian come from? Well, if we back up years and years and years, at one time there was this just great big mass of gases, and okay, where'd the gases come from? You get my point? You keep going back, keep going back. They can't give you an answer. Well, where did that come from? Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Why did I, with what I've just told you, underline that invisible? Because of those microbes. We didn't know they were there. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. Scripture. Bible. Remember my journey? My journey was, I started off growing up, I grew up in the church. I went to school, and for the first time in my life, started questioning what was in that Bible. Continued on my journey and started finding the information I needed, to some scientific information that supports, that helps me understand. My own mother-in-law said, "Jimmy, you have little faith." And at the time, that kind of made me mad. But this journey has brought me to where I am today, and now I've got the information that I need to support the scientific information that I personally needed to increase my faith. And then I call this my verse. Because, you know, as I told some people the last time I gave this talk, I've been reading the Bible since as long as I could read, since I was about 13 years old. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the Word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. You know, I was just reading one night, and all of a sudden, that verse hit me like a freight train. Because where'd it come from? Where'd that monkey come from? Where'd that amphibian come from? Where did that mass of primordial gas come from that they try to teach you in school? Where did it come from? And you can't get an answer. But God gives us an answer right here in Hebrews 11:3. What is God created, what is seen by out of what is not seen? God gives us an answer. Hebrews 11:3. This has been my journey of trying to share information so that people that end up struggling like I did maybe will find the answers a little more quickly than I did. Because that journey for me, from the very first questions to the answers that I started getting, were probably 10, 15 years. You know, while we were living in Baton Rouge, there was a large billboard. And if you ask your kids about the Big Bang Theory, they've probably heard about it. But this billboard had a slightly different twist on it that I really liked. It had big, bold letters, "The Big Bang Theory." And it said, "God spoke and bang, it happened." I liked that. While we were, I think, at a Lads to Leaders convention several years ago, one of the Christian bookstores up there, I actually found that as a bumper sticker. And I carry it with me when I give talks and say, "Look, you know, here is the Big Bang Theory. Genesis 1:1. God spoke and bang, it happened." I certainly appreciate your time this morning. We, associated with Apologetics Press, appreciate the opportunity to come and speak and to share this information. But remember, we thought that Superfund in Louisiana, that was going to be my lifetime job. When I was hired to go down there, I was told, "Jimmy, you'll retire working on this project because we'll never get this site cleaned up." The 188 wells that were put in to pump it, they've all been dismantled and removed because we were able to show the EPA, we understand the chemicals are breaking down, we have natural attenuation going on at the site, we understand what the mechanism is, this microbe is breaking down these compounds, EPA signed off on it. Now, only thing that's being done is monitored. They go out and take samples from these wells about once a month to show that what we predicted was going to happen. Matter of fact, to give it some validity, the model that I did We had one well that was located about 100 feet from where we knew the plume was in the subsurface. We knew that if we take these wells offline, this plume in the subsurface is going to migrate out a little bit further. Let's say the plume is in the subsurface is right here where I'm standing, and we've got a well there at the doorway. The model predicted that it was going to continue to move to the door, but it was going to reach steady state conditions right about there. And it was going to reach that door in 5 years. And the model predicted 5 to 7 years. It hit that well in 5 years. So that gave us some more validity to the model we had developed. But because God has put this design in place, created these microbes, they're eating this waste, we were able to quantify what's going on. We knew it was breaking down. Now we've got the mechanism. We understand the mechanism that's causing this to happen. And the EPA signed off on it, and we shut down that well field of 188 wells. And I worked myself right out of a job. Thank you for your time.